Hey, everybody. Welcome to this special episode of Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer and professor. Naomi and I are at the Canadian Music Hall of Fame.
Been at the National Music Center, downtown Calgary.
So Nickelback is being inducted into the Hall of Fame next year, 2023. There's no really display for them yet, but there is a little circle on the wall. A pretty small one, I have to say.
Yeah.
Considering they're the best-selling Canadian band of their generation.
So let's see here. We have like all these different pictures of bands, and they're each in a circle, and some of the circles are way bigger than others.
Yeah, like Arcade Fire.
Huge.
Is huge, but and above it is just a small Nickelback circle. So what does it say about Nickelback? If you're of a certain age, you probably remember this song. But if not, let me remind you. How You Remind Me by Nickelback was the most played song on US radio in 2002, the year after it was released. And according to Nielsen SoundScan, it was played on the radio more than any other song that entire decade. And you can understand why. It's catchy. It rocks. Okay, take that for what it's worth from me. I'm not a rock and roll aficionado. In the early 2000s, when I had a choice, I was mostly listening to hip-hop, especially on my iPod at the gym. But I was also spending a lot of time driving around the suburbs in St. Catharines, Ontario. That's where I grew up. And because I was driving a lot, I was listening to the radio a lot. Now, shout out to my mother for lending me her purple Ford Escort wagon whenever I needed it. It was definitely a sweet ride, and I got looks around town, but there was no way to plug my iPod into the stereo system of the wagon. So for the most part, I just had to be content with what was on the radio. And what was on the radio was Nickelback. This and other songs by them. Nickelback had two more number one singles on that same album, Silver Side Up. And for the rest of the decade, the albums and the hits kept coming. Did I like these songs? For the most part, I did. But did I ever tell anybody? It would have been shameful in my circles to admit that you liked Nickelback, or even to defend them from criticism. I shouldn't overstate this. I wasn't an active fan of the band. I was never going to go buy a Nickelback album, but by contrast, everyone else in polite society seemed to hate them. That Nickelback sucked was the consensus you'd encounter in print, on the internet, on TV, among critics, commentators, and celebrities. One of the earliest examples of this is a 2003 episode of Tough Crowd, a talk show on Comedy Central hosted by Colin Quinn. This is one of his guests, comedian Brian Posehn.
No one talks about the studies that show that bad music makes people violent. Like Nickelback makes me want to kill Nickelback.
That crack was funny enough that Comedy Central replayed the clip in station promos for several months. This ensured that millions and millions of people repeatedly heard that joke. And that definitely helped get the anti-Nickelback bandwagon rolling. But celebrities were far from the only people expressing their distaste for Nickelback. We're into the mid-aughts now, the very beginning of social media. MySpace launched in 2003, Facebook in 2004, and Twitter in 2006. In those earliest days of social media, one of the things people wanted to share is that Nickelback was terrible. That was far from an original opinion, but that was the point. Because you could assume that everyone else thought Nickelback was bad, finding a new and creative way to insult them became a competitive sport for people online. A way to test their powers, and to get likes and shares and followers, of course. And so Nickelback became a punching bag in the public discourse.
If you play a Nickelback song backwards, you'll hear messages from the devil. Even worse, if you play it forwards, you'll hear Nickelback.
That's my co-host Naomi reading some classic mean tweets about Nickelback.
Warning, if you see posts offering free clip of the new Nickelback album, do not click. It links to a free clip of the new Nickelback album. It says, still a better band than Nickelback, and it's a picture of a rubber band.
Anti-Nickelback sentiment may have peaked in 2011, when an online petition was circulated to remove Nickelback from the halftime show of the NFL Thanksgiving game in Detroit. Nickelback hadn't done anything wrong. There was no scandal. It was simply that the band, according to the petition, was embarrassing. I'm not sure that an online petition with 55,000 signatories is exactly newsworthy. Right now, I'm looking at a change.org petition to save Grace the Turtle, which I'm all for. It has 113,000 signatures, more than double the Nickelback petition. In any case, the narrative about Nickelback had been established, and the media kept reinforcing it. Certainly, more people saw the news about this petition than actually signed it. After that petition, the band appeared in a Funny or Die skit. Here's Nickelback's fictional manager talking to Chad Kroeger, the lead singer.
Guys, a little real talk. We're in crisis mode right now. Okay, the backlash against you guys playing the Lions-Packers game Thanksgiving is bad.
It can't be that bad.
Can't be that bad. Okay, dude from Nickelback. People signed an online petition.
Full credit to Nickelback for having a sense of humor about this. And why wouldn't they? Being talked about all the time was good for business. Here's a 2012 tweet from Nickelback's Twitter account summarizing their situation pretty well.
Yes, we suck. We get it. Just shut the fuck up and let us keep making millions of dollars. Hashtag shut the fuck up.
The Nickelback sucks meme was incredibly resilient. It lasted for about 15 years. As late as 2017, the Canadian sketch show This Hour Has 22 Minutes was making fun of Nickelback. They did a parody of a drunk driving awareness program.
If it's your first drunk driving charge, you'll be hit with a hefty fine, then forced to listen to 10 torturous tracks from Nickelback's 2001 CD, Silver Side.
Yeah, the major is a wise man.
No, you can't.
Get it as a drunk man.
What are you doing?
By now, the joke was getting old, and the Nickelback sucks meme was losing steam. It was partly because the band themselves were not as popular, and when Nickelback did come up, the narrative about them was changing. In 2017, Nickelback was interviewed on Q with Tom Power, CBC Radio's flagship arts and culture program. This was the first time Nickelback appeared on that show. Think about that. The most commercially successful Canadian band of their generation took 21 years to be interviewed on Canada's most important arts and culture show. Here's Chad Kroeger again.
We're not the cool indie band. We're not like Arcade Fire, or we're not like every critic, I think they know that they're just simply supposed to like those bands. I don't think you're supposed to like us. Mm-hmm. We're that, you know, kind of a little bit of a blue collar band.
I feel like that tide is turning though, but right.
As Tom Power says in that clip, the tide was turning and liking Nickelback was becoming more respectable. Nickelback's appearance on Q was proof of that. This changing attitude is summed up in a 2018 promotional clip from the Marvel movie Deadpool 2, starring Canadian actor Ryan Reynolds, who goes on a pro-Nickelback rant that is only partly ironic.
50 million albums worldwide, 11th best-selling musical act of all time, Billboard's most successful rock group of the last decade, 6 Grammy nominations, 12 Juno Awards, those count, 6 Billboard Music Awards, 2 American Music Awards, 1 People's Choice Award, Canadian, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Now, in 2023, Nickelback are being inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, achieving yet another level of cultural respectability. Clearly, something's changed. Liking Nickelback publicly, even honoring them, is perfectly fine now. But why have attitudes towards Nickelback shifted? And why were the band so hated in the first place? That's what I'll be examining in this special episode of Sweater Weather, The Other Side of Nickelback. Naomi and I are at the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, and we're going to talk to people about Nickelback.
Yeah, we have to get our courage up because we're a little shy.
We're a little shy. First time doing this. Let's go. Hey, do either of you know the band Nickelback? We're doing a podcast about them. What's your first name?
It's Aaron.
What do you think about the fact that a lot of people for a long time on the internet and elsewhere were saying that Nickelback sucked? Do you think that was fair? Do you think that was right?
I feel like I probably did say Nickelback sucks. So,
yeah, I appreciate the honesty.
I guess over time your opinions can change on things.
Why do you think people might have not liked them?
Them in particular.
Yeah. I actually really don't know why it was such a like disliked thing. I feel like if you think of boy bands, which Nickelback was like a pop band.
Right.
They were not like NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys in a similar sense, but they also weren't like a hard rock band in a comparison. So maybe they were just like in between genres struggling.
Right. That's a good point. In between genres and maybe making people on either side mad at them.
Yeah, I would say that's probably an accurate viewpoint of them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hi there. Could you talk to us for 30 seconds about Nickelback, either of you? What's your first name?
My name is Eddie.
Did you know that Nickelback were being inducted into the Hall of Fame next year?
I did not know that, but I know they're from Hanna, Alberta, and I've been there before.
I haven't been there.
I did Seismic there for a couple of weeks, so I spent some time in the town.
What do you feel about the controversy about Nickelback? You know, the Nickelback sucks meme?
Yeah, you know what? Like, there's this certain kind of, like, stigma around Nickelback because they may sound like Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, you know, that twang, like a hurl, you know, that stuff. Creed.
Yeah.
You know, Theory of a Dead Man, all these groups were kind of given a stigma because they kind of sounded like Pearl Jam a little bit. And, you know, and then people kind of hate on them because they kind of sound like perhaps people that influence them.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen. I don't hate on Nickelback for that.
Look, love or hate Nickelback, I'm not here criticizing your tastes. Art is very subjective. We like what we like, and what we like is probably specific to a genre. You like rap music or folk music. Maybe you don't really like country music or classical music. That's a good place to start with Nickelback. What genre of music are they? When Nickelback started making albums and touring in the mid-1990s, their music was grunge rock. Although Nickelback arrived on the scene after the biggest names in grunge music, bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Jane's Addiction. Here's a little bit of one of Nickelback's early songs, Leader of Men, from 1998. Think I've forgotten. This is a good example of Nickelback sounding very grungy. Grunge was a messier, darker rock music. It was sometimes called alternative rock, and it was supposed to be an alternative to mainstream rock of the 80s, bands like Kiss, Bon Jovi, or Def Leppard, who played tidy, radio-friendly songs and sing-along stadium anthems. Grunge presented itself as anti-pop, as anti-establishment, as anti-music industry. Grunge musicians and other alternative artists worried incessantly about selling out, that is, changing your art to achieve wealth or fame. Selling out had many potential forms. Maybe it was signing your band to a major label, or selling your song to be used in a television commercial. Famously, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana accused Pearl Jam of selling out, and he claimed that Pearl Jam were purveyors of corporate alternative cock rock fusion. Sometimes just having a popular audience, as opposed to a small, specialized group of fans, was a sign that you had sold out. Selling out can be a confusing notion, because if you're trying to make art that is relevant to people out there, as well as trying to make a living doing it, you need to sell it to somebody. And the careers of musicians are very volatile. Even if you're very popular right now, you have no idea how long that will last, and it probably won't last long. So unless you have something else to fall back on, maybe family money, it makes sense to get paid when you can. Anyway, you already know where this is going when it comes to grunge. Alternative rock became so popular in the 90s that, before long, it was the mainstream. After it became popular, grunge's anti-establishment self-conception didn't really make sense. By the end of the decade, grunge's biggest bands fell from prominence, quit, or sadly, died. Grunge was burning out around the time that Nickelback emerged. Nickelback are sometimes considered post-grunge. And as the name implies, post-grunge owes a lot to grunge music, especially its distorted guitars and growling vocals. You know, like this. But overall, post-grunge songs are more polished and structured, and the lyrics are more straightforward, less elliptical. In other words, post-grunge was more accessible and radio-friendly. And that was for a good reason. In the late 90s, the changing reality of the radio business also impacted alternative music's fate. In the early years of grunge, there had been a vibrant landscape of independent music stations across the continent, each one making independent programming decisions, and many of them choosing to play new, interesting, and risky music, which is partly how grunge had gotten its start. But that began to change in the late 90s. In 1996, the year of Nickelback's debut record, the U.S. Telecommunications Act drastically shifted the radio landscape. This new law removed the limits to how many radio stations a single entity could own. Soon enough, the Texas-based conglomerate Clear Channel began buying up literally thousands of radio stations across the U.S. Of course, the majority of Canadians live close to the U.S. border and listen to plenty of American radio. And although the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, the CRTC, moderates the Canadian market differently, media conglomerates here also grew following the American trend. Clear Channel later became iHeartRadio. And in Canada, iHeartRadio operated in conjunction with Bell, one of our own media conglomerates. For example, iHeartRadio and Bell now own and operate 97.7 Hits FM in St. Catharines, the rock station that introduced me to Nickelback back in 2002. And they also own CJ92, the rock station in Calgary, where I live now. Corporate consolidation meant that local stations lost control of programming choices. Instead, DJs were instructed to play company-wide playlists that were dictated by market testing and upper management. Here's media historian Brian Rosenwald speaking to WNYC's On the Media.
Consolidation and these big corporate ownerships create risk-averse companies, risk-averse executives, executives who want to program something that they know will work.
This meant that the most accessible music, the poppiest, was getting played the most, and there was less space for different genres. Not only was there less stylistic diversity on the radio, but fewer and fewer songs overall were being heard. A few big winners, if they were chosen by the radio conglomerates, would get played everywhere all of the time. This was the radio landscape that Nickelback was trying to break into. And so it made sense that their music would evolve to be less grunge and more pop. In an early interview, Nickelback's lead singer Chad Kroeger admitted that he intently studied radio hits so that he could imitate them in his songwriting. He told the magazine Canadian Music that, quote, "I study everything. I would dissect every song that had ever done well on a chart. There are so many things you can do to make a song stick in someone's head." Beginning in 2001 with Nickelback's breakout album, Silver Side Up, their songs become more direct, and the lyrics also became more straightforward, whether they're describing the hedonistic life of a rock star or just having a good time at a party. The results speak for themselves. In 2002, Nickelback became one of the few musical acts to gain heavy rotation on commercial radio.
So I love Nickelback. Their first few albums I thought were great. And then hearing that they were from Alberta, their music was phenomenal.
Here's friend of the show Rod, speaking from a fan's point of view about Nickelback's change in musical style.
I don't remember what album Leader of Men was on, but I remember in the 90s, yeah, and being at the shop I worked at, night shifts, me and another guy would just listen to Nickelback, and he was a big guy who wanted to be a rock star, and his thing was karaoke, and he would sing all those. But it made me love Nickelback. I love them. And then they slowly became very popular, and then their music was less meaningful as they changed what they wrote about. And then I started to really dislike Nickelback. So I joined the masses at that point.
According to the standards of grunge music, did Nickelback sell out? Definitely. They began to consciously apply the formulas of popular music and essentially became a kind of pop rock. If you judge Nickelback as a grunge band, you're probably not going to like them. And that is the case for most rock critics in the early 2000s who lead the anti-Nickelback charge. Their tastes were formed in the older days of alternative rock radio, of grunge. Nickelback's turn to pop formulas was disappointing for those critics. Here's a sample from a Rolling Stone article about Nickelback from 2004 that summarizes critics' collective response to Nickelback pretty well. Quote, "Only in a mainstream rock landscape this dull could these bootstrappers thrive. Throughout many interchangeable albums to come, Nickelback's essential facelessness will remain intact. Like so many hard rock bands of their era, The group generates but one thought. Eddie Vedder, you have so much to answer for. The reference to Eddie Vedder, the lead singer of Pearl Jam, is proof that the critics are judging Nickelback by the standards of grunge rock. And that is understandable, considering that Nickelback have inherited a lot of their style from the original grunge music. But how far should we go, really, in judging Nickelback by this aesthetic standard of an older music, one that was adapted to a different radio landscape, a different economy? It seems that the further we get from the 90s, the more the public forgets or simply disregards the standards of grunge music. To the new or naive listener, instead of being a degenerate example of grunge, Nickelback are the purveyor of some incredibly catchy songs. So that's one reason why Nickelback's reputation has recently improved. And of course, if you were just a casual radio listener like I was, you were probably never judging Nickelback according to the standards of grunge rock. One last thought on Nickelback's genre. You might notice that Nickelback, especially in the mid to late 2000s, begin to harken back to an older kind of popular rock music. For example, in 2005, Nickelback covered Queen's stadium rock anthem, We Will Rock You. And their 2008 single, Burn It to the Ground, quite honestly, could be a song by Kiss. As I mentioned earlier, grunge music had been a rejection of that kind of rock. So again, it makes sense that critics and audiences with alternative sensibilities hated Nickelback when they were doing this. But in turning back to an older style of rock, Nickelback was reading the tea leaves and getting ahead of a trend. Remakes, revisitations, reimaginings of all kinds in all media have come to dominate our cultural landscape. In music, Nickelback might have been one of the earlier adopters of this nostalgic mode. Anthemic rock may have sounded hopelessly out of date to some, but clearly it responded to a nostalgic yearning in audiences, a desire that has only grown in the last decades. So along with criticism for selling out, maybe Nickelback deserves credit for being, weirdly, ahead of their time. Hey, do you know the band Nickelback? So Nickelback are being inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame.
Time. Yeah. I think they've been an integral part of Canadian music. It seems an interesting, it's a bit dichotomic how people love and hate Nickelback, but yeah, I think they've done a good job.
I think there's a lot of people privately enjoying Nickelback, absolutely, like on the radio, yeah, and then not saying it because everyone else was making fun of them, it seemed.
Impossible not to sing along with, right? So if it came on the radio, if you're a hater, I know people would still sing along with it. So,
that's
yeah,
right. That's yeah, right. Are you from Calgary? Do you live here, or you're from
Central Alberta?
Yeah. Alberta. Okay.
The nostalgia of them being successful from small town Alberta.
Yeah.
Hannah's pretty tired.
I love their sign, the home of Nickelback. Oh, when you dive into Hannah's, so sweet.
Nickelback's success in the early 2000s was tied to their intense radio play. So we should think about who listens to the radio and who doesn't. According to a recent Nielsen study, 66 to 70% of all radio listening happens in a car, depending on your demographic group, age, sex, etc. And who exactly drives cars? Not surprisingly, if you live further from the city, you spend more time in a car. A 2008 study showed that those who lived 25 kilometers from a city center spent an average of 1 hour and 23 minutes in a car per day. That was compared to 55 minutes in a car per day for those who lived within 5 kilometers of a city center. When it comes to regions, people in the West drive more as well. This is intuitive if you've lived in both Western and Eastern Canada, as I have. Inhabited centers in the West are further away from each other than they are in the East. All of this makes sense when you find out that the most popular genre of music on the radio is country music. So if you're popular on the radio as Nickelback was, a lot of the people listening to you live in rural and suburban areas. And Nickelback themselves reflect this non-urban demographic. Nickelback are from Hannah, Alberta, a small town, population 2,500, which is about 2.5 hours east of Calgary. That's about 43 plays of How You Remind Me, by the way. Despite Nickelback having moved to Vancouver in the mid-90s to pursue their musical career, Nickelback still had the vibe of small-town guys, especially Chad Kroeger, the lead singer and most visible member of the band. Chad Kroeger appeared in videos in leather jackets and bootcut jeans. This was at the height of mid-2000s hipsterism, when the cool kids were wearing skinny jeans, checked shirts, and big glasses. Whether you liked it or not, Nickelback's look obviously worked for them, and it helped establish their identity. That was an identity in contrast to hip urban kids and the kind of music they normally liked, including indie rock. In an earlier clip, we've already heard Chad Kroeger point out this difference.
We're not the cool indie band. We're not like Arcade Fire. Mm-hmm. We're that, you know, kind of a little bit of a blue-collar band.
While mainstream radio consolidated, making it harder for new bands and new music to get heard, independent or indie rock flourished on the internet. In some ways, indie rock was the true heir to grunge, at least its claims to being alternative to the mainstream. Canada had a vibrant indie scene in the mid to late aughts. Bands like Wolf Parade, Broken Social Scene, Stars, and of course Arcade Fire could find significant audiences on the internet. The arrival of MP3s, that is, the digital file for music, revolutionized how music was distributed. For the first time, songs could be shared on the internet through social media sites, especially MySpace, and through file sharing software like Napster and LimeWire. Musicians could distribute their material widely without the help of radio. There was also the burgeoning world of music blogs and review websites like Pitchfork that spread the word about bands through internet communities. So, if Nickelback owed their popularity to radio, indie rock owed its popularity to the internet. And who exactly was on the internet in the aughts? Access to the internet and social media has always been unevenly distributed between densely and sparsely populated areas. According to a Pew Research poll, in 2008, around the time we're talking about, residents of rural areas were 12% less likely to own a computer than those in urban areas. That gap has narrowed a little since, but other inequalities persist. According to a 2021 Pew Research poll, people in households that make $30,000 a year or less are 33% less likely to own a computer than people in households with incomes of $100,000 or more. If you're listening to indie music on the internet, especially in the aughts, you are probably from a relatively high-income household, as compared to those who would primarily hear music like Nickelback on the radio. This is to say that there is a class distinction in listenership between your average Nickelback listener and your average Arcade Fire listener, what Chad Kroeger meant when he called Nickelback a blue-collar band. And to get back to the Nickelback sucks meme, I think it's safe to assume that the sport of Nickelback bashing on social media was disproportionately the work of those who had easy access to the internet, people from higher income households, and people in highly populated areas. This includes critics, celebrities, and other tastemakers. People who work in the culture industries overwhelmingly live in the cities. The creative type, living in a hip urban neighborhood, was such a trope in the early aughts that urban studies theorist Richard Florida thought they constituted a new class, the creative class, taken from the title of his famous book from 2002. And it's fair to say that the creative class generally didn't like Nickelback. When you've sold 50 million records like Nickelback have, your fans are a little bit everywhere. But sometimes it seemed a mystery how Nickelback could be so popular on one hand and on the other so despised. And the reason is it was different demographics doing both. Sorry to bring politics into this, but since we're talking about the rural-urban divide, it's impossible to avoid. Rural areas tend to vote for conservative or right-wing parties, while urban areas vote for liberal or left-wing parties. This isn't always true, and it hasn't always been the case historically either, and there are plenty of regional variations on this. But since the 1990s, the rural-urban divide in voting has grown dramatically. You can look at practically any electoral map in Canada or the United States and see this trend. For example, the riding that includes Hanna, Alberta, Nickelback's hometown, has long been a conservative stronghold. In the most recent provincial election, the United Conservative Party was elected with almost 77% of the popular vote in that riding. And in the most recent federal election, right-wing parties received about 85% of the popular vote. Members of Nickelback are also directly related to people in conservative politics. Chad Kroeger and his brother Mike, who's the bassist in the band, their grandfather was Henry Kroeger, a conservative MLA from 1975 until his death in 1987. He was also musical and played bass in a band called the Tory Blue Notes. Hannah's water filtration plant is named after Henry Kroeger. To use an American reference, Nickelback seem like red state rockers. In 2019, two representatives of the U.S. House of Congress got into a tongue-in-cheek debate about Nickelback. As you'd expect, it was the Democrat bashing them while the Republican defended them.
That's probably about the percent of people who think Nickelback is their favorite band in this country. It's pretty low. And I think if you look at it, Nickelback's your favorite band. One more reason why there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans.
My colleague from Wisconsin, I know he did not mean to offend the many... many thousands upon thousands of Nickelback fans in his district in Wisconsin.
In our politicized cultural landscape, liberals may have sensed in Nickelback not just music they didn't like, but a politics they didn't like, making them a more acceptable topic for public criticism. And the same went for conservatives, for whom liking Nickelback or defending them was an act of political significance. In this way, Nickelback became part of the broader culture war fought between liberals and conservatives. Online, liberals generally have the numerical advantage, which helps explain Nickelback's fate in those online discussions. According to a recent survey, the use of Instagram, Twitter, WhatsApp, LinkedIn, and Reddit is more common among Democrats than Republicans. It's only on Facebook where recently parity has emerged between liberal and conservative users. While Nickelback's political identity, or at least their perceived political identity, made them continual targets online, it also propelled Nickelback to greater and greater notoriety. In fact, Nickelback's last big turn in the international media cycle was fueled by politics. In October 2019, in the run-up to the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump tweeted a well-known Nickelback meme, an image taken from their 2005 hit, Photograph. It's probably Nickelback's most famous song, partly because of the popularity of this meme, which had been around for years. In the well-known video for Photograph, Chad Kroeger holds up a picture to the camera and sings,
"Look at this photograph. Every time I do it makes me laugh. How did our eyes get so red? And what the hell is on Joey's head?"
Looking at the photograph as instructed by the song, it seems the thing on Joey's head is a colander of some sort, maybe with duct tape on it. Meanwhile, in the photo, Chad Kroeger is giving the rock on devil's horns. Anyway, the point is it's a bittersweet, nostalgic reverie about growing up. And it's a really nice looking video, full of golden prairie sunlight. It was actually filmed in Hanna. Yeah, sure, it's corny, which is why it became a song people loved to parody online. What people did is take the opening frames of that video and replace the photograph with whatever they wanted. The most popular one was called Look at This Graph, with, well, a bar graph replacing the photo.
Look at this graph!
Of course it's silly, but it has literally tens of millions of views, and it's great publicity for Nickelback. Here's Chad Kroeger in another recent interview with Tom Power.
How are you with the parodies? Photograph got parodied a lot online.
Well, see, the thing is, we can take any of them we want down, because it's our music, it belongs
right,
to us. So
right.
We have the ability to pull them down.
Yeah.
So we leave them up because we think they're funny.
So you like them?
Sure.
So the photograph meme had been used for years, when in 2019, Donald Trump used it. He tweeted a version of the meme with a different Joey in the frame. That is, Joe Biden and his son Hunter, alongside a man that the video identified as, quote, Ukraine gas exec, implying that Joe Biden was engaged in corruption in Ukraine. The video was only up for a few hours, but that's all it took for everyone to notice, and for Nickelback to enjoy a 569% increase in people streaming their music online. But soon enough, the video was removed for copyright infringement. As Chad Kroeger has said, the band normally allows uses of their copyrighted material, but not in this case. The media and people online read this as Nickelback's anti-Trump statement, and the tweets and think pieces abounded, relishing Nickelback's epic dunk on Trump. Liberal and other anti-Trump commentators especially enjoyed this little bit of news because Nickelback had always had the image of red state rockers, of Republicans. But actually, if you're looking for it, you might find other evidence of Nickelback not liking Trump. In a 2017 song, Feed the Machine, Nickelback maybe criticizes the recently elected Donald Trump. It's a song about authoritarianism, which the video makes clear too. The lyrics go, addressing those beneath from high above, convincing his belief for what you love, baiting every hook with filthy lies, another charlatan to idolize. In 2017 anyway, these lyrics would have a particular anti-Trump resonance. Donald Trump and his style of populism had scrambled political identifications. In the eyes of many liberals, the reputations of formerly despised political figures, people such as George Bush and Dick Cheney, were recuperated when they claimed to be anti-Trump. It seems this happened to Nickelback as well. For any liberal person or institution who would have considered Nickelback conservative, this event proved in a big way that at least Nickelback were not Trump supporters, and so maybe they weren't so bad after all. Got a very long playlist
of
Nickelback.
I'm so glad we asked you.
Yeah, great person to ask. What do you think? Why do you think people made fun of them?
I honestly don't know. I grew up as a loud and proud Nickelback fan, so I'd always play it. My friends would complain and then start singing along in the car, so I never really understood it. I think that they're starting to get a little bit of a better rep now, at least from what I've seen. I think that they're not hated on quite as much, but I think, maybe a little bit of surprise from some people too.
It is surprising to see how Nickelback, once so despised, has been granted cultural respectability now. Probably the biggest reason that Nickelback's reputation has been recuperated is that they just keep going. It's been 26 years since they released their first studio album. And in November 2022, they just released another called Get Rollin'. Nickelback have been around long enough that they've transcended the culture wars and have achieved a kind of cultural consensus, in Canada at least, where we're eager to canonize artists who have international success. People and institutions can agree that Nickelback are a significant band, whether or not you ever thought they were good. And while Nickelback don't dominate radio any longer, they have plenty of new fans who listen to them on apps like Spotify and Apple Music. In the abundance of the online streaming space, genre distinctions don't mean as much as they used to. Younger listeners who come across Nickelback's catchy songs don't have the same values and expectations as earlier listeners did who were steeped in grunge music and alternative culture. All this is to say that Nickelback have outlasted their detractors. If the pen is mightier than the sword, then I guess the guitar is more powerful than the pen, and a catchy song more memorable than a mean tweet.